Dr. Ron Carlson, president of Christian Ministries International, has traveled and spoken in 78 countries on 6 continents. He's a recognized authority on world religions, non-Christian cults, and Christian apologetics. This tape is entitled, Evolution versus Creation.
This morning, I want us to talk about a very fascinating topic, that of the question of origins. Are we, as Time magazine recently said, an accident evolved out of slimy algae? Or are we, as Genesis 1 says, a unique creation of God? You know, what is the scientific evidence? Because how you answer that question of origins ultimately determines everything else in life. You know, whether you are an accident evolved out of slimy algae, or whether you are a unique creation of God, will ultimately determine your value of human individuals. It'll determine your basis of morality. It'll determine your meaning and purpose in life and your ultimate destiny. It is the most fundamental question that anybody can ask. 2 years ago, my son, who is a junior in college, he and I were traveling throughout New Zealand. I had been invited to lecture in all the major universities of New Zealand, in Auckland and Wellington and Christchurch, on the scientific evidence for creation. And after 3 weeks in New Zealand, we went over to Australia, went diving on the Great Barrier Reef for several days, and just had a phenomenal time. And then we flew back down to Sydney, Australia, and boarded an airplane for an 11-hour flight back to Los Angeles. The flight from Sydney to L.A. is the longest flight in the world, where you're never over land. And it's always fascinating when you get on an airplane for 11 hours to see who you're going to be sitting next to. And my son, we got on this big 747. My son was sitting in the seat next to the window. I was lucky, and I got the center seat. And pretty soon the plane began to fill up, and a lady about 40 years old came and sat down next to me on the aisle, and it was obvious she had an Australian accent. And so I asked her, I said, "Ma'am," I said, "tell me," I said, "well, why are you going to the United States?" And she said, "Well, I'm a professor of biology here at the University of Australia." And she said, "I've been invited to give a series of lectures on university campuses on the east coast of the United States." I said, "Well, that's interesting." I said, "Tell me," I said, "what will you be speaking on?" She said, "Well, my topic is evolution, ecology, and the spiritual interrelatedness of all things." Well, my son just kind of turned to the window and started chuckling to himself, thinking, "Boy, the Lord has a great sense of humor." And, you know, she had no idea who I was, and so I asked her, I said, "Well, tell me, ma'am," I said, "what do you mean when you use the term evolution?" She said, "Well, you know, about 15 billion years ago, there was a hydrogen explosion called the Big Bang." And she said energy moved out at the speed of light, forming galaxies and stars and planets. She said about 4.5 billion years ago, our Earth came into existence. She said it was about 3.5 billion years ago that we had a pool of blue-green algae floating around, and she said somehow that algae turned into fish. She said one day those fish then crawled up on land and became amphibians and turned into reptiles, and she began to go through this whole evolutionary scenario that you see on the screen behind me. She said, "You know, about 1 million years ago, we were all swinging in the trees from our tails." She said about 1 million years ago, our tails fell off. We came down out of the trees and began to walk upright, bipedal, And she began to go through this whole evolutionary scenario that you've all been taught in high school and college. And I said, "Well, that's really fascinating." I said, "Tell me," I said, "what do you mean when you say the spiritual interrelatedness of all things?" She said, "Oh," she says, "you know, we're all one with nature, one with the universe." She said, "The earth is our mother, and we've all evolved out of Mother Earth, and we're all one with nature." And I said, "Well, that sounds a little like the New Age movement." She says, "Oh, you know about the New Age?" I said, "Oh, a little bit." And she began to tell me all about it. Well, the plane had already taken off, and we were heading out over the Pacific. And after she had been talking for about 30, 40 minutes, she finally turned to me, and she said, "Well, tell me," she says, "what is it that you do?" I said, "Well, you know, it's interesting. I said, I happen to do the same thing you do." She says, "You do?" I said, "Yes." I said, "In fact, been here in New Zealand the last 3 weeks lecturing in all the major universities." She said, "You have?" She says, "What were you speaking on?" I said, "Well, my topic was why evolution is scientifically impossible and why we're not spiritually interrelated with all things. Well, you know, it's really interesting. As soon as she found out I was a Christian, and as soon as she found out I was a creationist, she said to me, she said, "You know the problem with you Christians?" You ever heard that? She says, "The problem with you Christians is you just have faith. You just have faith." You ever heard that? I said, "Well, that's interesting, ma'am." I said, "You know, everybody has faith." I said, "You had faith when you boarded this airplane that this airplane could hold you up for 11 hours and take you across the Pacific." I said, "You had faith in the pilot you had never met that he knew how to fly this airplane." I said, "In fact, you had faith when you sat down in the seat tonight that this seat could hold you up." I said, "You know, everybody has faith." I said, "Ma'am, it's not a question of whether you have faith or not. The question is, what are you putting your faith in? And is what you're putting your faith in a valid basis of faith?" You see, understand this morning. All of you sitting here have faith. You either have faith in a totem pole, or faith in astrology, or faith in Mother Earth, or faith in yourself, or faith in Buddha, or faith in God, or faith in something, but everybody has faith. It's not a question of whether you have faith or not. The question is, what are you putting your faith in? And is what you're putting your faith in a valid basis of faith? Now, I said to this lady, a PhD in biology, I said, "You have faith in evolution. I have faith in God and creation." I said, "You know, they're both faith propositions." I said, "You're a scientist. You know that science, by its very definition, is limited to what you can observe and what you can experiment with in repeatable units within a three-dimensional world." I said, "Now, obviously, no one observed the origin of the universe, and it's obvious you cannot repeat the experiment. Therefore, we're not talking scientifically, we're talking philosophically." And I said, "The question today is, you have two philosophical faith propositions, evolution and creation." I said, "The question is, based upon the scientific evidence that we all have, and we all share the same data, we all have the same scientific facts, based upon the scientific evidence we have today, is it more logical, is it more rational, and is it more scientific to put your faith in evolution? Or is it more logical, is it more rational, and is it more scientific to put your faith in God and creation?" I then asked her a very interesting question. I got it from Dr. Colin Patterson, former head of the British Museum of Natural History, who was an evolutionist his whole life and has recently become a creationist. Dr. Colin Patterson has begun to ask this question of evolutionists all over the world. If you know someone who's an evolutionist or a teacher who's an evolutionist, just ask them this question sometime. It's very interesting. So I tried it out on her. I said, "Ma'am," I said, "can you name me just one thing that you know is scientifically true about evolution? Just one thing. Can you name me one thing you know is scientifically true about evolution?" Well, her immediate answer surprised me. She said, "Well, that's impossible." I said, "Well, ma'am, that's the point. You know, there is no scientific evidence for evolution. In fact, it all demonstrates that we are a unique creation of God." This morning, I'd like to talk about the scientific evidence. Are you an accident, or are you a unique creation of God? First of all, what is the theory of evolution? The theory of evolution, as it is being taught in our universities and schools, and when I was doing my both undergraduate and graduate work in philosophy of science, I specialized in this area of evolution, taking every course I could in biology and biochemistry and paleontology, the study of fossils, physical anthropology, the study of human evolution, zoology. And as you know, they teach that some 3.5 to 4.5 billion years ago, there was this large inorganic ocean of nitrogen, ammonia, salts, methane, carbon dioxide bubbling away. Blub, 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 poof! They say there arose an amino acid. Blub, 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 poof! There arose another amino acid. They say a bunch of amino acids got together to form peptides, polypeptides, combination amino acids. form protein molecules, the building blocks necessary for life. And they say this, that this non-living matter rose upwards to greater and greater complexity and organization over billions of years, finally to become living matter. They say that living matter then rose upwards to greater and greater complexity and organization, finally to become conscious matter. But that conscious matter rose upwards to become self-conscious matter, rising upward to gain ethics, values, aesthetics, rising upwards to a God consciousness. And the theory of evolution today assumes the upward progression, that everything has moved from chaotic simplicity upwards to greater and greater complexity and organization, all by chance. Well, what is the scientific evidence? Are we an accident evolving upwards to greater complexity and organization? Or are we, as Genesis 1 says, a unique creation of God? First of all, I want to ask the question that Time magazine asked this year. How did life begin? Dr. George Wald, professor of biology at Harvard University, who won the Nobel Prize in biology in 1971, writing in Scientific America on the origin of life, makes this statement. He says, when it comes to the origin of life, you have only two possibilities as to how life arose. He says, one is spontaneous generation. The other is a creative act of God. He says, there is no third possibility. Now, Dr. Wall of Harvard says that spontaneous generation, the idea that life arose from non-living matter, he says that idea was scientifically disproved 130 years ago by Louis Pasteur, Spallanzani, Reddy, and others. But he says that leads us scientifically to only one possible conclusion, that life arose as a supernatural creative act of God. But then in his article, he adds these words. He says, but I will not accept that philosophically because I do not want to believe in God. Therefore, he says, I choose to believe in that which I know is scientifically impossible, spontaneous generation arising to evolution. Now, what was Dr. Wald of Harvard saying? He was saying that you today as students have only two choices as to the origin of life. Now, understand this. There are not 3, 4, 5, or 100 different ideas. In fact, you can only think of two possibilities. Either life arose spontaneously by chance, spontaneous generation, or was a creative act of God. Now, what was spontaneous generation? That was the idea held for some 2,000 years, all the way back to the Greek philosophers who taught it, that life was generating from non-living matter. Now, people got this idea, and Dr. Wall uses these illustrations in his article. He says people would observe, for example, that if you put a piece of meat out in the sun, and you let that meat rot and putrefy and decay, people observed that over a period of time, that decaying meat would spontaneously, poof, generate maggots, which would turn into flies. People also observed that if you put some rags and cheese in the corner of a house, that over a period of time, those rags and cheese would spontaneously, poof, produce mice. People also observed that if you had a stagnant pool of water, that over a period of time, that stagnant pool of water would spontaneously generate wrigglers turn into mosquitoes, or tadpoles turn into frogs. And so the idea was held by many people, folks, that life was generating from non-living matter. Well, we laugh about it now, but folks, it was widely held until 130 years ago. When a man named Louis Pasteur, we get the term pasteurization of milk. Pasteur, known as the father of modern-day biology, in his laboratory in Paris, France, demonstrated through a variety of experiments that when you put meat in the sun and you let it rot and decay, the meat does not generate maggots, but rather flies are attracted to the decaying meat. They lay their eggs and produce the maggots and turn into flies. It was Pasteur who demonstrated that when you put rags and cheese in the corner of a house, that they do not produce mice, but rather mice sniff out the cheese, they build their nest and have their young. And the same with the stagnant pool of water. It became, 130 years ago, a basic axiom of biology, number one, that life only arises from life. It is scientifically impossible to get life from non-living matter. This is known today in every textbook as the law of biogenesis. You might write it down. The law of biogenesis, that life only comes from life. It does not come from non-living matter. Now you say, well, obviously that destroys the whole foundation of the evolutionary theory. You say, well, how do they deal with it? Well, if you take biology in college, just look at your textbook. It's very interesting, almost every textbook in this country, the first two chapters will talk about Louis Pasteur and how he disproved spontaneous generation and the law of biogenesis, that life only comes from life. But usually the last paragraph of the second or third chapter will say, but in order to be a modern day biologist, one must accept the hypothesis of spontaneous generation, after they just told you it's scientifically impossible. And then the rest of the textbook will be teaching the theory of evolution. You know, don't bother me with the facts, let me just hold to my bias presuppositions. Now, I want to teach you this morning some basic questions that you can ask your professors when they begin to teach evolution. Like, number one, you need to raise your hand in class when they begin to teach evolution and say, Professor, how do you get life from non-living matter when it is scientifically impossible, the law of biogenesis? Life only comes from life. Well, the standard answer I used to get at the University of California is they would say to me, well, Carlson, you must assume by faith that contrary to the laws of science, somehow it occurred. And then they would teach the theory of evolution. And I would say, but Professor, I'm really not interested in your faith. What is the scientific evidence? What are the scientific facts, not your assumptions of faith? A second issue that I raise with evolutionists is in regards to the basic laws of probability. Now, we could spend all morning on this one. You may have read, for example, what Sir Fred Hoyle, speaking recently before the British Academy of Science, shook up a lot of people. His statements were published in all the major science journals. Sir Fred Hoyle, considered one of the leading astronomers and mathematicians in our world today, speaking before his evolutionary colleagues, said, quote, he said, let's be scientifically honest. He said, as scientists, we all know that the probability of life arising by chance, he said, is the same probability as throwing a six on a dice 5 million consecutive times. You know, try that one sometime. But then he went on to add these words. He said, let's be intellectually honest. He said, as scientists, we all know that the probability of life evolving to greater and greater complexity organization by chance, he said, is the same probability as having a tornado tear through a junkyard and form out the other end a Boeing 747 jetliner. You know, random impersonal chance does not produce complexing organization, only greater chaos. Take, for example, it's very interesting. If you ever study biochemistry, you know that every living cell, no matter how simple, every cell in plants, in animals, in human beings, has what is called a complex enzymatic protein metabolic motor. Or simply put, every living cell, no matter how simple, has the ability to extract energy from its environment in order to supply energy for the reproduction of that cell and for other cell needs. Now, every living cell has it. The ability to extract energy from its environment to supply energy for the reproduction of that cell and for other cell needs. Now, for life to exist, you must have that metabolic motor. But that metabolic motor, folks, which is absolutely essential for life, can only be produced by life. Now, the riddle becomes this. How, when no life existed, did substances come into being which are absolutely essential for life, but can only be produced by life? You have the same problem, for example, with DNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid. You've probably seen pictures of the double helix strands of the genetic code called DNA. DNA is absolutely essential for life, but it can only be produced by life. how when no life existed? Did DNA and RNA and other substances come into being which are absolutely essential for life but can only be reproduced by life? Well, the evolutionist has no answer for this problem. And so he says, well, you must assume by faith that contrary to the laws of science, somehow it occurred. And you as a student must say, but Professor, I'm really not interested in your faith. What is the scientific evidence? What are the scientific facts? Well, let's go on to simpler things. Like the laws of thermodynamics. If you've ever taken a course in physics, you've all studied the laws of thermodynamics. In fact, the laws of thermodynamics govern all of the physical sciences. Now, the first law simply states that all energy and matter can neither be created nor destroyed. The amount remains constant. But the second law of thermodynamics we want to talk about this morning, which is known as the problem of entropy, E-N-T-R-O-P-Y. The second law of thermodynamics simply states that all the energy in the universe useful for work, kinetic energy, is in a process of running down. Now, what that means in simple terms is this. The second law of thermodynamics states that everything in the universe, all energy and matter, is moving from a state of organization and complexity and is degenerating downwards to chaos and disorganization. That everything runs out of energy, everything goes from organization downwards to chaos. This is why, for example, no one has ever invented a perpetual motion machine. Everything runs out of energy. Everything goes from organization downwards to chaos. We observe it throughout the whole natural world. For example, all you rich people in California here, I'm from Minnesota, and you students, you drive what these days? BMWs, Lexus. You know, if you were to go buy yourself, for example, a new 1997 Porsche or BMW, whatever you're driving these days, and take it out to Big Sur on the Pacific Coast near Santa Cruz there in the mountains, and just park it out there in the mountain coast and leave it there for 5 to 10 years, what would happen to your brand new shiny car? No, if it wasn't stolen, the guy says. No. Yeah, be stolen. No, if it wasn't stolen, if you just left it there, what would happen? It'd begin to rust? Begin to decay? If you left it there long enough, it'd begin to disintegrate? See, it's a basic law of physics. Everything goes from a state of organization complexity downwards to chaos and disorganization. We observe it throughout the natural world. I could give you hundreds of illustrations. I often tell students, the easiest way to prove entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, is just clean your dorm room sometime. Just clean your dorm room, get it real neat, and just leave it for 1 week. I guarantee you, you'll see entropy at work. Second law of thermodynamics. The basic law of physics, everything goes from organization downwards to chaos. Well, we could give hundreds of illustrations, but who can tell me what the problem is in regards to the theory of evolution? What's the problem? What? It's backwards. It's going in the opposite direction. You see, folks, the theory of evolution says that everything is moving upwards to greater and greater complexity and organization all by chance. But, folks, the laws of physics, specifically the second law of thermodynamics, says that everything is going in the opposite direction from what evolutionists assume. Now, obviously, this presents a terrible problem for the evolutionists. And many of them do understand the problem. I was watching Regis and Kathy Lee live on television last fall, and it was very interesting because they had on Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan, who produced the Cosmos series and the books on evolution, and he and his wife had written a new book on evolution that they were talking about on Regis and Kathy Lee live. And it was very interesting because 6 weeks before Carl Sagan was on the program, I had spoken at Kathy Lee Gifford. Her brother is a pastor of a Baptist church up in Ontario, Canada. and just a dynamic person like her sister. And I'd been holding seminars at Kathy Lee Gifford's brother's church, and her mom and dad had been up there, and they had bought all my tapes and cassettes, and they said they were going to bring them back and give them to Frank Gifford and Kathy Lee. And she must have listened to the tape on evolution, because it was really interesting. They're interviewing Carl Sagan live, and halfway through the interview, Kathy Lee Gifford says to Carl Sagan, she says, "Well, what about the second law of thermodynamics?" And I'll never forget, Carl Sagan just looked at her like, "Where did you get that?" She said, "Well, what about the second law of thermodynamics?" And I'll never forget Carl Sagan's answer live on television. He said, "Well," he says, "all you need to overcome that is enough time." He says, if you allow enough time," these were his exact words, I wrote them down. He said, "if you allow enough time, eventually anything is possible. You simply need a greater time span in which to allow organization and complexity to occur." You know, time is the magic pill for the evolutionists. If you just allow enough time, he said, eventually anything is possible. I'll never forget the first time I heard that at the university in one of my classes. I raised my hand in class and I said, "You know, professor, that's like saying that if I were to take an airplane up over Hume Lake, California, and I was flying this airplane at 5,000 feet over the ground, and in this airplane I had neatly stacked 10,000 3x5 cards. I said, you know, the theory of evolution would assume that as I flew over Hume Lake at 5,000 feet, that I could push out those neatly stacked 10,000 3x5 cards out the window, and that they could randomly sort and select themselves to spell out Hume Lake Christian Camps on the parking lot out here." Well, you say, "That's ridiculous. They're going to be flying all over the lake and out over the mountains and hills." Well, it's a basic law of physics that everything goes from organization downwards to chaos. So along comes Carl Sagan and the evolutionists, and they say, "Oh, well, what you need is a greater time span. You simply need a few more million or billion years in which to allow organization and complexity to occur." Well, I raised my hand in class. I said, "You know, professor, that's like saying that instead of flying at 5,000 feet, I'll now take the airplane up to 25,000 feet. Now at 25,000 feet, I'll push out those neatly stacked 10,000 3x5 cards, and they will now have a greater time span in which to randomly sort and select themselves to spell out Hume Lake Christian Camp on the parking lot out here. What's going to happen? They're going to be heading out towards Fresno and Visalia and out over the eastern side of the Sierras. Why?" Folks, it's a basic law of physics that the greater the time span, the greater the chaos and disorganization. And every time the evolutionist adds a few more million or billion years, he's simply nailing another nail to his own coffin. The greater the time span, the greater the chaos. This spring, I was invited to lecture at the University of Minnesota. Campus Crusade and InterVarsity Navigators had rented the Science Auditorium at the University of Minnesota and invited me to come and lecture for 3 hours on the question of origins, evolution or creation. And they had invited all the science students and teachers from the university. We had a great time. During the question time, one of the students said, "Well, Carlson, you know, your second law of thermodynamics, he said, things running out of energy, going from organization to chaos." He says, well, we overcome that because we're replenishing energy from the sun." This is a common argument you'll often hear from people. "You know, we're still getting energy from the sun. So whatever we lose it, things..." I said to him, I said, "Do you understand the second law of thermodynamics? You know, it states that the increase of energy only speeds up entropy. It doesn't bring complexity." I said, "For example, if you have a car at the bottom of a hill, and you want to get this car up the mountain, how do you get it to go up the mountain?" You say, "Well, you need energy." "Okay, well, pour energy in. We'll pour gasoline into the gas tank. Now we got energy in the car. Is the car going up the hill?" It's got energy in it. No, simply adding energy doesn't drive it up the hill. What do you need? You need a complex mechanism called an engine to transform random energy into kinetic energy. The question is, where do you get that complex mechanism? Just like photosynthesis in a plant. How, when no life existed, did mechanisms like photosynthesis come into existence that are required to transform sun rays into chlorophyll for the life of a planet? Well, the evolutionist has no answer. He says, well, you just have to kind of assume that somehow it happened. Don't bother me with the facts. And even if you have this complex mechanism, the car starts going up the mountain, what happens? It goes flying off the first cliff. Why? You not only need a complex mechanism, you need a driving mechanism to drive it up. If you're a student, you might try this sometime. When I was studying evolution, you know, I used to sit in back class and just ask this question sometime. Just say, Professor, when they start teaching evolution, just say, what do you do with the second law of thermodynamics? And if they don't understand it, explain it to them. But you cannot allow them to get away with their philosophical assumptions of faith. You must say, Professor, let's be scientific. What is the scientific evidence? Well, then they come up with what they believe is their last great argument. But what about the fossil record? I mean, did not Darwin teach that if evolution were true, we would find the evidence in the fossil record by finding millions of transitional forms, the so-called missing links? It's interesting. Newsweek magazine had an interesting cover story a while back entitled The Mysteries of Evolution. And on the cover, they had a picture of Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard, probably the leading evolutionist in our country. Just want to read a paragraph of what Newsweek says concerning this issue. Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard and Niles Eldridge, a paleontologist at the American Museum of Natural History, have collaborated on a paper intended to resolve a professional embarrassment for paleontologists. Their inability to find fossils of transitional forms between species, the so-called missing links. Darwin, and most of those who followed him, believed that the work of evolution was slow, gradual, and continuous, and that a complete lineage of ancestors shading imperceptibly one into the next could, in theory, be reconstructed for all living animals. You see, Charles Darwin, who wrote the book Origin of the Species in 1859 and later his Descent of Man in 1871. You see, Darwin said that if evolution was true, he said we would find the evidence in the fossil record by finding millions and millions of transitional forms, one species evolving into another species. We would find pigs turning into cows. We would find cats turning into dogs. One species evolving into another species. Millions of missing links, transitional forms, would have to be in the fossil record. Let me read on. In practice, Darwin conceded that the fossil record was much too spotty to demonstrate those gradual changes, though he was confident that they would eventually turn up. But a century of digging since then has only made their absence more glaring. Paleontologists have devoted whole careers to looking for examples of gradual transitions over time, and few exceptions have failed. Is Eldridge and Gould's notion to call off the search and accept the evidence of the fossil record on its own terms, rather than transforming gradually what we find in the fossil record as everything appearing fully formed after its own kind? You see, folks, what we find in the fossil record are not millions of transitional fossils, the supposed missing links. We in fact have yet to find one transitional fossil. In fact, everything appears fully formed after its own kind. Now, you see, Darwin said that we should be finding millions of these transitional fossils. We have yet to find one. I was speaking up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, last fall, and had the opportunity, took one afternoon and drove 100 kilometers east of Calgary to Drumheller, Alberta. Drumheller is the largest dinosaur fields in North America. and went out to see the dinosaurs. I love dinosaurs. They're cool. We're going to talk about dinosaurs tonight. Don't miss tonight. And it's going to be fascinating. But the Canadian government has recently built the largest museum on evolution in North America, called the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology. And went out there to see this incredible museum. Cost me $10 to get in. Took me 4.5 hours to walk through this whole museum on evolution. Do you know that they had thousands of fossils in this museum? They had fossils of shellfish. They had fossils of trilobites and brachiopods. They had fossils of fish and amphibians and reptiles. They had fossils of dogs, of cats. They had fossils of horses. They had fossils of dinosaurs. Hundreds and hundreds of fossils. It was fascinating. Took me 4.5 hours to walk through. You know, I got to the end of the museum, folks, and do you know that I had not seen a single transitional fossil in the entire museum on evolution? Now, Darwin said if evolution is true, he said we would find the evidence in the fossil record by finding millions of transitional fossils. Here's the largest museum on evolution in North America. There was not a single one. Personally, I was feeling a little ripped off. You know? I mean, there is such a thing as consumer fraud and false advertising. So I went to see the museum director. He happened to be in Europe at the time, so I talked with one of his associates. And I said, "Sir," I said, "I just spent $10 and 4.5 hours going through your museum." He said, "Oh, yes, isn't it wonderful?" I said, "Well, there's just one problem." I said, "I did not see any evidence for evolution." I said, "Where are the transitional fossils?" Well, he looked at me and he said, "Well, as soon as we find one, we'll certainly have it in our museum." Now, the sad thing is that a lot of students assume that our museums are filled with these supposed transitional fossils. Folks, we have yet to find one. In fact, we have never observed evolution in the fossil record. We have never observed evolution in the natural world. In fact, evolution exists only in the imagination of evolutionists. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me how smart we've become as a nation. You know, when I grew up in Long Beach, California, when I was 5 years old and went to kindergarten, you know that when I was in kindergarten, they told me that a frog turning into a prince was a nursery fairy tale. But you want to know something, folks? When I got to the University of California, you know what they told me? They told me a frog turning into a prince was science. We've really gotten smart. No wonder the Bible says it's only the fool who would say in his heart, "There is no God." Foolishness. Because there is no evidence, you need to understand what I'm about to tell you. Because there is no evidence for evolution. We've never observed it in the fossil record. We've never seen it in the natural world. It exists only in the imagination of evolutionists. Because there is no evidence for evolution, scientifically, what they are now doing in every university in California, in every museum in this country, is they have now redefined the word evolution. And you need to understand this, because when you're taught it in school, you need to understand the new definition. When you go to the Royal Tyrrell Museum, the largest museum in evolution, they now have the new definition, a big billboard as you walk into the museum giving the new definition. Here it is. It says evolution equals natural selection. That is now the new definition of evolution in our universities. Evolution equals natural selection. What is natural selection? Natural selection is a basic law of science. Natural selection goes on every day. Natural selection is change within species. You can take a red rose and cross it with a white rose and you get what? You get a pink rose. That's change within species. Natural selection goes on every day. You can cross a golden Labrador retriever with a collie and you get a hybrid. That's change within species. Every time a baby is born, they're a hybrid of the parents. That's change within species. And what they are now trying to convince students at the university level is this. They're trying to convince you that because we see change within species, therefore evolution is true. No, it's not. Evolution is one species evolving into another species. We have never observed that in the fossil record. We have never seen it in the natural world. Change within species goes on every day. That's basic science, basic DNA genetics. But having one species evolve into another species, that we have never seen anywhere in the world. We need to not allow them to get away with the redefinition of terms. Change within species is basic science, but that is not evolution. Tonight we're going to continue part two with fossils, cavemen, dinosaurs, geology, and the age of the earth. You don't want to miss tonight. It's going to be really interesting. But I want to conclude this morning by simply asking the question, does it really matter how you answer the question of origins? I was speaking at a university back on the East Coast. For three nights I was in the science auditorium, and the last night the head of the science department said to me, he said, Ron, he said, what you're teaching is not only good science, he says it's basic common sense, but he says, I have to admit to you, I'm still going to teach evolution. And I said, why? And this professor said to me, he said, I'm going to teach evolution because it is morally comfortable. Morally comfortable. I said, what do you mean? He says, you know, as long as I believe I'm nothing but an accident evolved from slimy algae, that I'm nothing but an animal, he says, I can live morally any way I choose. He says, I can go to bed with any girl I choose. If there is no God, and I'm simply an animal evolved from slimy algae, there are no moral consequences. But he says, as soon as I admit that there is a creator, he said, then I become morally responsible to that creator. And he said, frankly, I don't want to be morally responsible to anybody. And I have become convinced today, students, that the issue of origins is not an intellectual one. I have become more and more convinced today that the real issue is a moral issue. That people understand as long as they believe they're nothing but animals, they can live any way they choose. But as soon as you admit there's a God, the whole ball game changes. For example, and I close with this one illustration. One of the biggest problems among young people today is the issue of self-esteem, self-worth. A lot of young people don't feel like they're very valuable. They feel like they're just nobody. I think it stems largely from what the world is trying to convince us of in regards to evolution. You can either choose an evolutionary, humanistic worldview, or you can choose a Christian worldview. Does it matter how you answer the question of origins in regards to something like self-esteem? In my book, Fast Facts on False Teachings, the chapter on evolution, I published the two views of self-esteem. I'd like to read them for you as we conclude today, and ask yourself, does it matter how you answer the question of origins? First of all, let me read for you the secular basis of self-esteem based on evolution. You are a descendant of a tiny cell of premortal protoplasm that washed up on an ocean beach 3.5 billion years ago. You are the blind and arbitrary product of time, chance, and natural forces. Your closest living relatives swing from trees and eat crackers at a zoo. You are a mere grab bag of atomic particles, a conglomeration of genetic substance. You exist on a tiny planet, in a minute solar system, in an obscure galaxy, in a remote and empty corner of a vast, cold, and meaningless universe. You are flying through lifeless space with no purpose, no direction, no control, and no destiny but final destruction. You are a purely biological entity, different only in degree but not in kind from microbes, viruses, and amoebas. You have no essence beyond your body, and at death you will cease to exist entirely. What little life you do have is confined to a fragile body, aimlessly moving through a world plagued by war, famine, and disease. The only question is whether the world will manage to blow itself up before your brief and pointless life ends on its own. In short, you came from nothing, you are going nowhere, and you will end your brief cosmic journey beneath 6 feet of dirt, where all that is you will become food for bacteria and rot for worms. Now, how does that make you feel? And you wonder why a lot of students have a problem with self-esteem, self-worth? That is the world's view, folks, of self-esteem. Let me read for you the Christian worldview of self-esteem as to who you are, and see if it matters how you answer the question of origins. Here is the Christian basis for self-esteem. You are a special creation of a good and all-powerful God. You are the climax of His creation, the magna opus of the greatest artist in the universe. You are created in His image, with capacities to think, feel, and worship that set you above all other life forms. You differ from the animals not simply in degree, but in kind. Not only is your kind unique, but you are unique among your kind. God has masterminded the exact combination of DNA and chromosomes that constitute your genetic code, making you as different from all others as every snowflake differs from the rest. Your Creator loved you so much, and so intensely desires your companionship and affection, that despite your rebellion, He gave the life of His only Son that you might spend eternity with Him. If you are willing to accept the gift of salvation, you can become a child of God, the King of the universe. As a Christian, you are clothed with the righteousness of Christ. He has given you special gifts and abilities to serve Him in a particular and unique way. Your Heavenly Father is sovereign and will allow nothing to cross your path that is not Father-filtered. He cares for you so much that He is available to you at all times and listens to every word you say. He cares deeply about your hurts and has a special plan and purpose for your life. He has given you the inspired Word of God as a roadmap of living. He gives you the truth that sets you free, a life that is abundant and eternal, a spiritual family that loves you and needs you. Your destiny is to live forever in a magnificent kingdom, to reign with Christ over the universe. You will forever enjoy the wonders of His presence and the marvels of His creation. You will spend eternity in intimate and joyful fellowship with your beloved Lord and your precious spiritual family. Now, how does that make you feel? The question of origins is the most fundamental question that anybody can ask. And as we continue tonight, I'll demonstrate to you that evolution is the greatest lie being perpetrated in our universities today. Folks, when Jesus Christ died on that cross 2,000 years ago, He did not die for evolved slimy algae. He died for you and for me because He made you, He created you, He loves you. And He desires to have a personal relationship with every one of you. We'll continue tonight. Let's bow in a word of prayer. Lord, we love You. And we worship You.